All right, we're recording now. Let's see. So my name is Michael Bricky, and I am here with Amanda Clark. This is Friday, January 7th, 2022, about 10 after 10 a.m. And we're going to be chatting about various things, I assume, mostly about Amanda's kind of evolution in her professional career and what she thinks about practice of public history and how she interprets things and stuff like that. So could you go ahead and give us just like a maybe formal or informal introduction of yourself, name, title, anything else that you find pertinent?
Okay. My name is Amanda Clark, and I have been, and my title is the Community Tours Manager for the Missouri Historical Society, which is kind of a general sounding title, but it's very specific. I run the CSTL tours, which are walking tours and bus tours. I got to create that program from the ground up and, you know, kind of nurture it into where it's going. My background is I have a degree in history with a focus in architectural history from the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. I'm not from St. Louis, but I've lived here about 18 years. I worked in architecture in marketing and communications for about 10 years for one firm that's pretty historic in St. Louis. Instead, a lot of historic restoration, a lot of big well-known buildings, period. And then I also worked for a firm that does museums and exhibits and aquariums and things like that all over the world. So really cool stuff. On the side, I had started a company called Renegade STL that grew out of my own frustrations at not hearing from diverse voices and there being kind of a set of gatekeepers for St. Louis architectural history, and also to provide opportunities for myself and for other people to get in on that and to do it differently. And I had amazing people that helped me with that and helped me make it what it became. We were in the New York Times in 2019. And yeah, from there, that's when I went over to the History Museum in the beginning of 2020.
Awesome. So I think we'll get into a little bit more detail. In full disclosure, you hired me to give some tours, so that's how we know each other. And this chat that we're having today is hopefully it's going to be printed out as an interview piece for the first issue of an upcoming journal's e-zine. Not really sure what we're calling it yet. But it's Informal History, Volume 1. So you gave us a little bit of background about yourself and how you got to where you are. So you said you've been in St. Louis for 18 years?
I have.
So did you come here for work, or did you come following a love interest, or was St. Louis just this place that you knew about that you moved to? Because I'm curious because there's a lot of talk in St. Louis about, you know, people, you're from here and, you know, you have your certain communities and people tend to, you know, stick with those cliques. And then there's another kind of conversation about transplants to St. Louis, and some people who live in St. Louis and from St. Louis are like, why would anybody even want to come here? And then some people are like, I like that nobody wants to come here. It keeps St. Louis. I get St. Louis because, you know, it's not so kind of like dynamic like other places that are seeing a lot of kind of like newcomers all the time. So what brought you to St. Louis?
So I came kind of for all those reasons. I had graduated college and didn't want to stay in my college town. I was newly married and we kind of threw a dart, you know, at a metaphorical map. And St. Louis was a place I had been when I was a kid to like for Girl Scout trips. I had done the, you know, go to the Arch, go to Old Spaghetti Factory, get out of town as quickly as you can. I had done that trip several times. It was about 3 hours from my small hometown in Tennessee. So it was a big city to me. I wanted to live in Chicago. My husband wanted to like not live in Chicago. So this was a in between, and his mom lived in Webster Groves. So it kind of just made sense as a stop off point. It felt like a stop off point for maybe other things. And then we got here and I fell in love with the place. I lived in Maplewood when I first moved here. When I came here 2 months before we moved here, I came to look at apartments, and his mom had picked all these places to go look at. And I got here and she said, okay, we get in the car, and we headed so far west out into the counties. And I just had this feeling like, nope, this is not what I want. And I had made an appointment with a company in Maplewood, and I didn't know what Maplewood was, had no idea what anything in the city was, but it felt right when I went there, and it felt urban enough for me and for this adventure we were going to go on. So, and she was so aghast. I mean, I can't imagine what was in her head as the thought that I was moving to Maplewood and that we were going to live in Maplewood and her granddaughter was going to live in Maplewood, you know, which is so bizarre to me now, thinking about that. But, cause she was raised in Webster. I mean, she was a St. Louis person, but she was a Webster person, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how we got here. And it just grew from there. And I lived in University City. And then I live in Webster now. Just, you know, life has brought me here. And, but as far as like being a transplant, I did get lucky when we first moved here that we did connect with a family member that was in a clique and was in a good clique, I think. It included the Bailey's that have like Bailey's restaurant. He had just opened the first restaurant. And so we got kind of lucky. And that was a connection, a social connection. And it was my little social hub that grew out from there. And so it does kind of speak to the St. Louis thing of if you can connect, there's a lot of connectors in St. Louis or people that live, I think they exist as hubs, as like social hubs. And if you get that hub, it goes out to another one. Someone needs to make a map of like social connections because we all connect back to each other somewhere. It's like a maternal haplogroup. Like we all come back to one social interaction. But that took a good 7 or 8 years to even grow into something that felt like family and life and community and all that. So it can definitely be, if you're not from here, I mean, it is tough because you just don't know what any of the stuff is. Like, why Maplewood? Why did she hate Maplewood? Like, that took me a long time to understand that and understood what she meant by different offhanded comments she would make about the city. But now I look back, I'm like, oh gosh, you were really racist. And I didn't realize what you were saying. But anyway, so I think that hopefully that answers your question about moving here. It is a challenge, but because I'm not from here, I am not beholden to any of the mythology of St. Louis. I don't give a crap about toasted ravioli. It's yummy. I make it in my air fryer, but it doesn't mean anything to me. So therefore, you know, I'm totally, and that helps. And that helps me then go back to people that are from here with that energy of, holy shit, do you know you live in a cool place? Like, you know, and that, that energy, I think is if you have good connections. And I know people that move here that didn't have that experience and they don't enjoy this place. So you gotta have that. And it's hard, I think, you know, living here there, because you mentioned kind of the energy some people have about why would you live here? St. Louis is a bad place. Do we want people to know that it's actually a really great place to live? And that's something that requires an energy that is interesting. And I read someone recently that kind of named it in a really good way. And she said, like, sometimes I have to leave St. Louis for a minute to like restore myself, almost like someone having to take like a break and then come back and love it, like be in, because it is frustrating to live here. It's really in Missouri, which who knows what the hell that is, you know, like, so it's a whole big complicated thing. And it's not easy, like the cities that are boomy and cool and slick, you know, and you go to those cities and there's nothing there I can't do here.
Yeah.
Literally. I mean, I just want to stay in the middle of I go to Seattle a lot and I want to stay in the middle of the street and be like, what the hell do you think is so cool about this place? Yes. Water. Awesome. Mountains, volcanoes. Cool. St. Louis. I don't know. You can do all this stuff and not, you know, drive 35, 40 minutes to get there. So.
Yeah. And not pay so much for just a small, like, bungalow.
If you're lucky to have that, like, you know, and it just feels really bizarre. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, I appreciate all that, and I can understand what you mean, because I grew up in Shrewsbury, So, you know, Shrewsbury, Webster Groves, Maplewood were, that's where I grew up. You know, I had kids in my school who lived in Webster, kids in my school who lived in Maplewood. And, you know, growing up in Shrewsbury, we thought the rich people lived in Webster Groves. So Shrewsbury was more of kind of like, I wouldn't call it blue collar, you know, but there was kind of a chip on the shoulder kind of mentality. And I got in, but at the same time, we still had elements of that kind of viewpoint that you expressed from your relation about Maplewood and what Maplewood represented. So it's, yeah, and that's kind of, I wouldn't say typical kind of expression of St. Louis, but common, you know, like the notion of certain places representing certain things and those things representing fear and bad. And yeah. So, yeah. So that was your first experience with St. Louis, and that's great. So I want to go back to what you said at the opening about your background. So you got a master's in history at Tennessee. Bachelor's in history at Tennessee.
I'm a unicorn. I live out in the world by myself. I have a bachelor's and I play with the big guys.
No. Bachelor's in history and with an emphasis in architectural history.
Yes. Yeah, cool. They didn't have an architectural history degree, so I took everything possible that was built environment focused. I had started off school wanting to be an interior architect or an interior designer myself, and I went to school in Chicago briefly and realized that was not what I wanted. And it's one of those like really clear moments in life you have where you shift a different direction. I was in drafting class in Chicago looking over Buckingham Fountain. Like my school was like right there. It was a building Frank Lloyd Wright had an office in, and I had a pencil and I was doing my drafting, and I put the pencil down and I thought to myself, I don't want to design this. I don't want to make this. I want to talk about this. And I called my parents that night, and I was in a car headed back to Tennessee 2 days later and just like shifted. And it's still really bizarre that I talk about it. That's my job all day long, is I get paid to talk about architecture and history. That felt really far away right now. Like those two points are so far from each other.
But. Yeah. So did you have any inclination when you had that thought about that you wanted to talk about it, who you would be talking to? Like, did you have an idea of what this kind of like imaginary audience was going to be at that point? Or did that kind of, did the public in your kind of practice kind of evolve out of what you ended up?
No, you know, it's a great question and one that no one's ever asked me. But my brain instantly thought like, I mean, yeah, I was totally thinking of myself in front of people that didn't know what we were. Like I was the bridge between those two things and making it accessible, making it exciting. But I never saw myself as a tour guide in the sense of like, we're on the boat, we're doing this, and we're pointing. I still don't see that. And I kind of bristle a little bit when I have to tell someone, you know, at a public history conference, I'm a tour guide, and their eyes kind of glaze over and say, but no, I'm not that kind of tour guide. Yeah. So
I don't work for the Chamber of Commerce.
Right. Although I wish I did, because I feel like we need that too. We need better of that. Mm-hmm. It was always a bridge position. Like I wanted to be the middle place. I never wanted to be, and this is kind of how Renegade grew in my head. I never wanted to be the person that was preaching to the choir. And sometimes I can be giving a tour, and if I see a whole bunch of people just nodding their head along with me, I'm not hitting the place I want to. Like, I don't want a bunch of people that already know the stuff just to come hear me talk about what they already know to make them feel smart about what they already know. That's a thing. And there's people in town that do that. And people love that experience. I wanted to create something different that brought people in to, you know, gave them access to that academic side of it, but also made it accessible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a great, great segue into another question that I had. And this kind of relates to just my knowledge about Renegade, but why don't, before we do that, why don't you tell us, where Renegade came from. Like what, so you were sitting in at a drawing desk in your program saying, I want to talk about this. And how many years later was Renegade founded, and what kind of process led to the establishment of this? What ended up being your private business for how many years?
Renegade was open for 9 years.
Cool.
And so it was the moment in drafting class happened, I think, in 1998, somewhere around there. So end of that century. Back to the comment of the pencil in drafting class. And then Renegade started in 2011. And in between there, about 3 years before Renegade, I had co-founded something called Moth Up St. Louis, which is when the moth, you know, it's on NPR, when the moth started gaining popularity, and that kind of storytelling and that kind of personal connection stuff started to grow. A friend and I, we called the moth and asked them to come to St. Louis, and we were going to, like, you know, coordinate this event. And they said, no, we're not interested in that, but we have this new program called Moth Up, and people can kind of, it's like almost like a kit, and you can create the moth in your living room with your friends and use our name. And there were about 5 or 6 of us around the country that did it, that started little moth ups. And we went from 6 people in her living room to 250 people every month for over a year at the duck in the duck room. Like, it was crazy. It was this crazy experience of storytelling and marketing and just learning all this stuff. And that started to wane, and it didn't make sense to me anymore. And so I walked away from that. We handed it off to another group that took it, and now it's called Second Tuesdays. But we, you know, we gave birth to that. I was doing the storytelling thing, but also I was a volunteer tour guide for Landmarks on Saturday mornings. And I loved doing those tours. I always had my notes in front of me, my script, did my thing. And one day I left it in the car, and it was like my worst nightmare that I was going to give the whole architectural history tour without my notes. You know, I don't know the date on that building. And someone at the end of that tour, this lady said, that was the best tour I've ever been on, because I had storytelling the entire time. And so that kind of gave me the idea. And then I saw other people having opportunities to get in front of people and talk about architectural history in St. Louis. I wanted that opportunity. And because I had just done Motha, which became to be known as St. Louis 10, I had the social capital. I had energy and momentum that I could shift over. I didn't want to lose that. And so Renegade kind of grew those connections I had made, the attention it had received, all of that was able to kind of transfer over to Renegade. But it was just me by myself, and I didn't know what I was doing, and just kind of took a chance on all of it. And then someone asked me when Arch Grants became a thing, the capital funding thing, one of the founders of Arch Grants, Jerry Schlichter, he knew that I loved history and did these tours, and because he worked with my husband, and he said, would you do a bus tour for the Arch Grants people? And I'm like, sure. And if anybody, when I do these interviews and we talk about like my journey to here, I get this cheesy place where I'm like, just say yes to anything, and figure it out. Because if I had said, I don't know how to do bus tours, no, I can't do that. But I did, and it was terrifying. And the most terrifying part of it was the first red light, because when you don't know what you're doing and you write a tour and you get to the first red line, like, you don't account for that. And you don't account for that, the silences and the slow. Anyway, so I just figured it out. And there was a guy named Ed Domain, who's left St. Louis now, and what they wanted was a bus tour that combined the history of St. Louis with the energy that it has right now, right? They were selling St. Louis on these capital funding financial people, right? And so that's what I had to do, was talk about money that was coming in, talk about what happened, but make it connect them to that history. Like, yeah, come here and live here, connect to this 250 years of history, make that. And this guy afterwards came up, and just like the lady that with the no note lady, Ed Domain came up and said, you're onto something here. Like that experience, you're onto something. And so that just, it went from there. And so I would say yes to a lot of random requests. You know, someone said, hey, can you give us Can you give us a tour about the history of the media in St. Louis? Yes, I can. And I would spend 3 months learning all about it and just doing all the, you know, just saying yes to stuff. Meanwhile, going through life and having a full-time job and kids. And I would walk away from Renegade for months because I didn't owe anything to anybody but myself. And then one day, finally, I think it was Michael Allen. We were in a conversation about getting paid to do it. I mean, because granted, I went like 2 years without getting paid for any of this. I would just say yes to stuff because I felt really weird asking money to people pay me for it. And then one day I was like, yeah, someone asked me to do something. I was like, yeah, that's $300. And I felt so ballsy. And so like, and they did. They were like, okay, no problem. And so that went from there. So that kind of, and then it didn't go anywhere until people came to it. Like until I had partners and other people that had skills that I didn't and could bring stuff to it. That's when it really became what people think of as Renegade, is those other people, people that came to it. Elizabeth Eichmann, Adriana Perone, like these women that came and became part of it. That's when it became what people think of as Renegade.
Awesome. So the people that came to Renegade, did they come on tours and say, hey, I want to be a part of this? Or were you soliciting for people to join in the effort?
So I was always soliciting in the sense that I was always I'm always open to part. I still am, right? Like I'm still open to I meet someone like, you know, I think you or make a good kind of, like you see it the way I do, like come be part of this. So I was always kind of watching. And there were people that came to be part of Renegade that weren't good fits early on, but that was okay. So, you know, again, nobody owed anybody anything. And then the first person that really came on with their heart was a lady named Adriana Perone. She's an architect. She has her own firm. We worked together. And so she and I did the whole damn city first, the big bus tour that really got us off on the map. And then Elizabeth Eichmann was on that first bus tour. She came up, you know, afterwards and said, I want to be part of this. And so, and then Adriana's work got busy and she stepped back. Elizabeth came in. And so like, it just happened very organically in that way.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. That's really cool. Just for the purposes of the typing up, can you spell Adriana's first and last name?
Yeah. Yeah. It's Adriana, and then her last name is Perr. I think it's Onne. Double check.
Okay. Do you think that Adriana or Elizabeth would have any problems with their names being in print?
I don't think so. I mean, I know that Adriana won't. I can't. Yeah, it's one N for Adriana.
One N. Okay.
One N in both of her names. So.
Okay.
AD. Sorry, Adriana. Just don't tell him I didn't know how to spell her name. so it's a cool name. And Elizabeth, I think, would be fine as well. She and I were in conversation this week. So, and I would love to give, I want them to have the recognition that they deserve in this because I get to do the interviews, but they put a lot into this, you know?
Yeah. Well, and just kind of an aside point, as you mentioned, it kind of grew organically. That's how I'm thinking about, you know, some of these interviews is like, where, as you were talking about the connections, the hubs, like where are people connected and finding those connections and then going and interviewing that person and seeing what their story is. So that's kind of where my head is at in terms of like connecting the dots of people that are doing, that are practicing public history in St. Louis. And yeah, so that's interesting to me.
Yeah, I have there's one of the other tour guides. I don't know if you've met him, Josiah Gunderson. And he
No, I haven't. Unless I met him briefly at if he was one of the guys that I met at in the parking lot on the rainy
that's funny.
Cold parents weekend.
Yeah. Yes, because he did a lot of those tours, and he is a young guy. He's not from St. Louis. He went on all of the CSTL tours when I first started. Like, he just went on all of them, even the virtual ones. And twice it was just me and him. I didn't know him. And I was like, you want to do this? It's just me and you. He's like, sure. And so I gave him a virtual tour. And he's now he's my most, most active guide. And I had to walk him through, like, hey, read these books. I had to help him get there. He didn't come with all that knowledge, but he wanted it. So he'd be a great person to talk to. I think he's going to have a perspective, especially if you're coming at like different ways to get into stuff. And
yeah,
he's a good one. He's a dancer. He's also a professional dancer.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah.
So he could do like some performance art in the middle of a tour.
He wrote a piece in the Link Auditorium in the Central West End, the Wednesday Club. That's where they practice. And he actually wrote a whole dance piece that's about connecting to the history of the place that they practice. That's like a modern dance interpretive thing. So he's doing some interesting stuff with history and dance that I would never think.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing.
So yeah, he's a good one.
So Josiah is Josiah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And then Gunderson with an eight, with an E.
Okay. Gunder.
Gunderson.
Got it. All right. Thank you. Okay. So I've got a few more questions, and I won't take up too much more of your time, but I enjoy talking with you. And yeah. And if you have to go, you can tell me, hey, I got to go in 10 minutes or something like that.
I can talk about me all day.
So the work that you're doing now, from the outside, people would define it as public history, right? So, well, they would characterize it as public history work. So do you have a working definition of public history? Like, how would you define public history?
I feel like when my son asked me, like, what does this word mean? And I have to like politely say, it's in the word. Yeah, I mean, I define it as doing history not in an inward way, like a researcher that just researches steamboats forever and writes all these papers on steamboats, not knowing who's going to read them. I know who's going to hear what I'm going to say. And I study and I interpret and I do what I do with the mind that there's going to be an audience that doesn't have the information I have. So that's how I see it. Whereas it's going to be going outward to varied audiences always. Okay. It's never going to be just for myself.
So what does public history do that history with a capital H can't or won't do?
I think it interprets for the audience. It either, you know, in some ways people can do the work for the audience. I hope that I don't. And I study the ways of interpretation and in communication and ways to get people to get to their own assumptions. So I feel like, you know, a historian might pull all the facts together and say, and tell the story. That's that. Whereas I'm going to tell the story and get you to ask questions and get you to get engaged with it and ask, you know, like there's a dialogue, whether it's in your own head or with me. So there's more to it than.
Yeah. And it sounds like what you're describing is like an interactive process between, excuse me, you as, you know, the person who is kind of leading this group and the group itself. And as you know, you've mentioned to me before that no two tours are the same because the dynamic between the guide and the group, it's always different. And the people that are there are going to ask different questions that cause, you know, different stories to come out and different conversations to evolve, I guess. Mm-hmm.
And it's so fascinating because that's and what I love is now there are conversations being had. I'm recently back from a conference. I'm very energized about this, but there's conversations being had about the interpreter themselves, the guide. What do I bring to this conversation and how I am a different person because of the person I'm talking to, mm-hmm. and being like decentering the guide, right? And making that kind of stuff is just really fascinating to me, the mechanics of it and how to be good at it and to make it meaningful. Not waste anybody's time, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a band that I love. They're called Over the Rhine and they're old, but, she has this great song that she sings at a lot of concerts first. And the song is called, I Don't Want to Waste Your Time. And she's like, I don't want to autograph the book you're never going to read. I don't want to, every song I sing is about something that happened to me. Like, you know, and it's still going to happen. That is always in my head in a way. Like, I don't want to waste anybody's time and just tell you a bunch of facts. Like, I want to make it mean something when you walk away from it. Now, that's a little bit of an ego trip too. That. It takes a little bit of that too.
I think getting in front of people and putting yourself out there requires a little bit of ego, at least, you know, something to say, I'm at least enough to say I'm worthy of being here doing this, you know?
Yeah.
What's your favorite story that you tell on your tours? Do you have one? Or maybe you don't have to pick one, like you don't have to pick your favorite, but what is one of your favorite stories that you like to tell? You don't even have to tell the story. Maybe, I mean,
yeah,
as you would on the tour.
Me not tell the story. lately it has been, and this is not, I don't want to say I'm ashamed of it because it's like not exciting maybe to other people, but it is very exciting to me. How the Eads Bridge also has the tunnel that's connected to it, and how the drama of the tunnel is so fascinating. And we don't ever talk about it. Like the book's like bridge and it's all about the bridge, but the company was called Bridge and Tunnel Company. So lately I have been very fascinated with the politics and the, like the idea of tunneling underneath a city at that time was crazy. And I don't know. Yeah. So I would like lately that is kind of one that's been in my heart. And I've enjoyed getting other people interested in that. That's an architectural, like that's a one that's like built environment stuff.
And I love that because what you're talking about, because you give these tours that are, you know, based in the built environment. And what you're just talking about now is the stuff that we don't see that is required of this environment that we're walking through. So the unseen, hidden, that's kind of a major theme, it would seem, of a lot of the kind of tours that you give, because as you said earlier, you wanted to do something, you wanted to present some stories and viewpoints that otherwise were not, you didn't see them coming in like the architectural history tours that you had been a part of or you had witnessed. So I think that's fascinating that you're looking at, or you're keen on, you know, the invisible or the subterranean, what's not seen.
Yeah, that is true.
And I have another question kind of built around the like that theme, I guess. The work you do writing these tours and leading them, ties together the built environment with local history. What do you think it is about, you know, being there, that you think people are drawn to?
I love, like a lot of times in the beginnings of a tour, when I'm doing the setup, right, I will use a line like, we're going to time travel a little bit. Or this is a neighborhood that we can, you know, you go around the corner and we literally could be like nothing's changed on this next street in 100 years, you know, physically. And so when you do that, then you're able to, you know, get people in their mind to go places and then connect to more stuff. So, there's just nothing can replace, I don't think, physically putting yourself in that place, because then you can imagine the person you're talking about walking down that street, and, you know, or how things have changed over time. How does it look now versus then? You know, it brings to mind on my Soulard tour, there is one building that has, you know, all the buildings have limestone foundations. That's fine. We can talk about that. I love geology a lot. And but there's one building that has one limestone block that is full of marine animals. Like it's some kind of cool worm, and you can see all of the little spine grooves on it. I mean, it is so cool. It's almost, but it's.
Is it carved or is it actual? Is it fossils?
Real. It's a real fossil. It is so cool.
That is
and
awesome.
I feel like we need like a big marker by it. Be like, look at this. Which then, so then when I've got people, you know, on that tour, that's such a cool moment because they connect not just to the, you know, to the building and to how people quarried rocks and all that kind of stuff, but like things that were there a long time ago. Like it's all right here still. Like
hundreds,
it's all still,
the hundreds of millions of years of history that allowed us to that created this stone right here. that's amazing. Yeah, I love that.
And I love that. And then which that then led me to learning, like I was studying the old courthouse downtown. And if you the National Park Service did an amazing preservation report on it a couple years ago that has a whole chunk of stuff on fossil content of all the rocks in the old courthouse. I may say cathedral, but in the courthouse. And so now that's part of that tour, you know, and connecting people to the geology. And that's something I personally am headed towards in my work, is connecting geology and urban geology to history and to people walking around and thinking about what's under their feet and how the buildings are built because of what's under their feet, and that kind of stuff.
Have you heard of a book called The Annals of the Former World?
No.
Okay, so that's the name of the book, The Annals, A-N-N-A-L-S, of the Former World, and it's like a cross continental kind of geological history of the United States. So it's thick, you know, but it's pretty well written. So it's not just like the Cretaceous period. it's very narrative, so it's good.
There was a guy in the 1980s that wrote a walking tour of the St. Louis riverfront from a geologic standpoint. And I found it at the MHS's Library and Research Center when I was writing my virtual tour about underground St. Louis. So cool, obsessed with this book. And then several months later, I went to do a video, an on-site thing at the Missouri Mines Museum, which has a geology museum. Old man comes out because they were closed and it's like old. I know he was in his 70s. We talked about it. He comes out and he's chatting with me and he's like, what do you do? And we're talking about it. And he's like, well, you know, I wrote a book like 40 years ago about the geology of the riverfront. And I was like, oh my God. I know it like totally surprised me. And I'm like, there's like three copies of this left. And so it was fun. Now it was fun to connect with him and what he loved 40 years ago and how he's built a whole career. And so now he's part of the story, part of the thing. And
that's fascinating. Curious how people connect, the ways that people come together. I think I had a question in my head that I didn't write down, but it just kind of escaped me. I remember now. The work that you do is very kind of, you know, as we're talking, kind of based in place, right? Just now you mentioned when you were giving your virtual tour of underground St. Louis. I think we're all curious about how this pandemic is impacting anybody's life and work. But I feel like this is a particularly unique profession in the context of what we're doing, what's happening right now. We're out of the lockdown era, but we're in the midst of another resurgence of a new variant, the Omicron.
Got a T-shirt in the mail, I'm sure.
But this is this is the time that we're living in right now. And so I guess maybe just like how did what when it when COVID-19 first kind of when it shut everything down, how long were you in your job as community tours manager, and in what and how did it transform what you did or what you needed to do to make this program still viable in a virtual space?
I feel like I was in a really lucky position because I had started 3 months before. We were literally launching the tours that week. We did all the media, we did all the stuff, everything was ready. We were launching that week, everything shut down. But I was the one person at the museum that within a week could do programming. And again, it was another one of those say yes things where in a meeting, they were like, okay, I think we have to do a virtual talk of some kind. Who can do it? And I was like, I'll do it. Figured it out. And I have a picture of that first one in my kitchen with like stacks of books and my iPad for my notes and my laptop, like, and I got all dressed up for it. And that seems so bizarre now, because now I know, okay, I need two screens and I'm going to sit right here and have, you know, and I know how to do it. Whereas then I didn't, but it was really cool. And it was, so not only could we do virtual and do some programming, and that gave me chances at the museum I didn't have before, because before I was just going to be doing these tours and I was over mm-hmm. here, but suddenly I could move over into the public history department and I could mm-hmm. be part of that group of people and head that up and, or not head it up, but you know what I mean? Like part of that learning how to do that. But then the tours were the only program that could exist in 2020 outside. Mm-hmm. So I was the only thing, I was the only person that was doing my normal job too. And so we were doing walking tours all over town. And so I had those two things. And then we did the virtual tours as well. And people loved them. And then people stopped buying tickets. And so now we're not even thinking about doing virtual tours again. Like this is all happening. We're shutting down programming, but nobody's saying, okay, trot out your virtual tours again, because yeah. we know nobody wants to go on those anymore. Like, yeah, you know, yeah. that moment has passed mm-hmm. in this experience that we're all having. I think we're mm-hmm. all just going to look out the window. We're not going to be watching yeah. stuff on.
Are those virtual tours archived on the website, or have they been recorded and saved for posterity in case nope. maybe no?
Nope. So the talks have, so there, I have a ton of talks on YouTube. So people can go to YouTube and watch my talks. That's fine. But the tours, I refuse to ever let them be recorded because they are just like the walking tours. And yeah. they only happen the one time. So I never wanted it to. Yeah. So I wanted it to be interactive. It was never just me talking. I required people to have their cameras on for the tours, which some people weren't expecting or prepared mm-hmm. for, and you know, and those were so much fun because it would just turn off into conversations and people could bring their own selves to it as well and not just be passively listening to it. They got interaction when they weren't expecting it, which was really, I think, really important at a certain point. Ways to connect with strangers and have moments that we weren't able to have out in the mm-hmm. world, we were able to have in those virtual tours. That's awesome. It's just like a walking tour, like recreating yeah. that thing, you know?
Yeah. So it, you know, it's ironic. The way that you describe it is like, because of the fact that you were hired on and, you know, you had to produce this programming that you were about to roll out. you were incredibly prepared, right? You shifted, and that seems to be, a common theme in your trajectory. You're very comfortable with, you know, pivoting in new directions when that is required of you. And not a lot of people can do that. And I commend you for that, for being able to, as you say yes to change. Because as you say, you don't know what you're capable of until you demand it of yourself, right? Because people could ask you to do stuff all day and you could say no because you don't think you can. So that's a great, I appreciate that story. What most excites you about doing this work in St. Louis?
When you ask that question, and my immediate thought was at the end of a walking, like just like in my head, I pictured the end of a walking tour when two people that didn't know each other stay behind and continue talking about what we were just talking about. Or two, you know, they stay back and they start, you know, like it continues with them. And so that was the, that was my immediate emotional response to your question of the connections that people, mm-hmm. that I'm able to make with people. So yeah, that's, I think just the connections, even if it sounds like a cheesy word or like a general, like, oh, just the connections, but like, it could be a lot, that means lots of things. Mm-hmm. Recently we were giving, you know, our Del Mar Divide bus tour is our most popular thing that we do, period. Which is fascinating because the museum does not it's not advertised anywhere. It's not written anywhere. You have to know I give them mm-hmm. to go on one. So for us to do them at such a number is fascinating to me. But one of them we gave was for Visitation Academy. They wanted to take some students out into the city to talk about where the school used to be. So we used to connect a lot of stuff. And so they were open to the idea of connecting the city, the school's history to white flight and to what did we leave behind when we left. And we get to Visitation Park, which is just north of, you know, Central West End. And we get to Visitation Park, which I had never in my mind connected to mm-hmm. Visitation Academy.
Yeah.
And we get out and this one girl was like, I cued her perfectly. And she goes, why would they put our school here? And it was like, thank you. That was so beautiful. Thing. So yeah, and just be able to connect her to that and to see, it's cool. It's really cool to see those unexpected ways that people connect to it.
That's great. And that first kind of, I guess that initial kind of emotional response you had about the two people connecting, I love that too. And like, that feeds that energy, right? Like you're tired after walking around for 2 hours, but when you see at the end, people carrying that excitement, that curiosity and continuing talking after your official tour is over, you realize that, as you said, you know, the decentering of the guide, like you are just a person in a group at that point, you know, and you were there for that connection between these two people who had memories that, or something that they were commiserating on. And I think that speaks to one of the major themes that we're trying to kind of bring out with informal history, is that everybody has a story, you know, everybody has experiences that can be, you know, incredibly powerful to other people, you know, like those personal experiences, I think, are what really speak to other people. You know, it's an individual experience that happened to you, but that's the human experience, you know, like we connect with each other on a human level. And I think that's an aspect of this kind of work that not a lot of people really talk about. You know, it's a very social enterprise, I guess, and socializing in that way.
And that goes two directions. You know, you have to also train in how to manage. You may have, because there's some people that talk too much. They want to. Mm-hmm. Want to centralize
it. They want to center themselves, yeah.
Yeah, and so you have to make it look like it's all, but there has to be techniques in place to manage it too, right? You can't just let everybody talk the whole time. So there has to be some intentionality along the way and some professionalism that you bring to it, so that people know they're safe with you too. You know, there's one guy that goes on our tours that does talk way too much. So I have to do things to make everybody else on the group know you're safe. I'm going to, like, we, you know, like this, you're okay. I'm going to manage him. You don't have to worry about it, like what's happening here. He's wonderful and he shares stuff, but it's a thing, you know? So it takes this, like, you have to train in it. You have to learn how to do it, but make it seem like it's totally easy, you know, like it's just happening naturally because it is, but also it is because you put things in place for it to happen naturally.
Great. And I think that would be a great place to end. But I would like to leave you, of course, the opportunity to say anything else you want to say about anything, you know, CSDL, Renegade, St. Louis, anything else you have on your mind?
Gosh, lots of things. I think there's, I don't mind being challenged in what I do. Right. And I think there are certain, I'm thinking of like our Hill neighborhood tour. And that's something that as a public historian, as someone who does this, I wrestle with who am I to give this tour? I'm not from this neighborhood. I can walk around Soulard and not think twice.
The notion of identity and representation and
You know, I go to Soulard, I talk about the Czechoslovakians. That's great. I talk about the Hungarians. I talk about the Germans, like, and what that means. But the Hill, I love giving that tour, and I loved learning about the neighborhood myself because I didn't know anything. That was a tour that I chose to do because I was avoiding the Hill's history because it felt nostalgic. It felt exclusionary. Like I was not part of a club, so therefore I know this, all the information I needed was out there already, but then learning about it was so much more fascinating. So I did it, but the community pushed back on who are you to come in and give our story. So I struggle with that, with some of the stuff we do. My hope is if you were to interview me in 3 years, my guides represent a big wide range of people and experiences. And not just, and are bringing their experiences across to something else. Like my dream is to have, you know, an architect of color or a tour guide of color giving an architectural history tour of Soulard. Like bringing that stuff, those things into it, that's a big challenge and where I wrestle the most with what I do. I don't want to be telling all of this stuff. I want to get other people telling the stuff and the stories, not necessarily people from the neighborhood, but other people bringing things to it.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. And that notion of kind of ownership of history and ownership of, especially like the story of the place that you live. That's a common kind of theme across the world in terms of, you know, the notion of, I've heard it in the world of journalism, the notion of like extractive journalism, where the reporter comes in, gets somebody's story, and then leaves, right? and there's that's obviously I'm not saying what that is what you're doing, but people who you know live places, they're always kind of curious about people walking around their neighborhood, you know, like, what are you doing here? Like, what is this? And that's something that's happened to me too, giving tours. So those are always can be really challenging interactions, but they're also incredible opportunities to open new avenues of dialogue where they hadn't existed before. So,
And St. Louis is so territorial. So we're not used to that. We're not used to someone, I feel like, or I say we as in St. Louis, like we've never had this before. We've never had a whole gang of people that go out, fan out as guides, right? We fan out, we go into these neighborhoods and we connect all this stuff. It's never been a thing like before. Whereas if you go to New York City, it's all over the place. Or Chicago, it's all over. They're used to people walking around pointing and talking. You know, there's an organization in New York called Big Onion Tours that I really admire. And it's all grad students and stuff that give these tours. And they're not from the places that they're talking about at all, but that's their area of expertise, right? So they bring it in. And I just think of, or it makes me want, like, think of like where we live and what we kind of where we started with this of the challenge of St. Louis is this is my place, my little fiefdom, you know, type of thing. And is there a way to push on that in a good way? That's what great. I'm doing.
Lastly, I want to ask, at the beginning of the interview, you said, you know, something about, like, we were talking about those kind of cliques and the closed off nature of the social world as it kind of is experienced by a lot of people in St. Louis. You've been here for 18 years, you said? You're essentially a native now, would you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, St. Louis is home. I mean, you, like, right? Yeah. So what do you, I don't know really how to ask this question, but what is it about, what is something about St. Louis that has produced meaning for you in your life? You know, it could be like, you know, memories of going to, like, yeah, I grew up in Shrewsbury. So going to the park, like going to Wainer Park, or, you know, a lot of people will say like something kind of like stereotypical, like the Cardinals, or Mark would say Provel.
Brutal about that. I feel bad when I repost, like, people that don't like Provel are jerks. I'm like, I'm not a jerk. Maybe I'm a jerk. But that's an interestingly hard question to, I mean, it's all, I mean, it makes me think of, like, when I first got here and someone gave me my little St. Louis history, a concise history. It's usually sitting right here.
I have concise that history. The red and white.
Blue and white. Well, mine's blue and white.
Oh, okay. Mine's red and white.
And it was given to me, and there was a little line in there in the first couple of chapters or whatever about tearing the mounds down and putting it in the river. And that's my first piece of St. Louis, like, what?
Yeah.
Not that I didn't know about the mounds, but just like the layers of history we live on here. And that, I think that's the connecting always with such a deep history in a city that we've written off and forget that it was the third largest city in the country, the fourth largest, in, like, you know, like that is endlessly interesting to me. Like, I love all of, and I love being part of that story. I love going to Forest Park all the time. Like, I feel like I freaking work at Disney World if I love Disney World. Like, and you walk in every day. Like, I drive to work every day and shit, like, this is and what is, like, what is that, like, what is that reverence I have for that place that I'm not from, that, you know, I didn't go to the World's Fair, nobody went to the World's Fair, but, like, why do I care about the World's Fair? Like, why do we make, like, you know, it makes me think and question all the time, and it's so freaking complicated here, and people, I don't think, realize outside of being here and being outside of what we do, just beautifully complicated it is, and it's not simple, and it's not, it is easy on some levels, and it's really, really not on others, and it's funny that you're from Shrewsbury, is, you know, before I lived in Webster, I lived in Shrewsbury for 2 years, and my daughter went to Webster schools. It's funny, I would always joke, like, no one ever says they're from Shrewsbury. I love that you're from Shrewsbury. but yeah, but even that, like, what does that mean? That house was half a mile from this house, right? That I lived in Shrewsbury. And it's like, I live in South Webster, which could be Shrewsbury. And, you know,
Yeah.
All of it's so complicated and fun. And
Yeah. And I love what you said. It's, I think you said it's so beautifully complicated. We'll have to roll the tape back, but it is, you know, and I think that's why I find studying St. Louis just so rich, because you think you know something, and then you keep reading or keep talking, and there's something new. There's always something that you didn't know about, another layer, as you put it, to complicate the still beautiful story. And I think that, you know, us at Informal History, we all have a love of this place because of its complicated, beautiful nature. So I really appreciate you giving us this time, Amanda. I know you're a busy person. I look forward to seeing this interview in print, and hopefully we can chat again soon sometime.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. This is so much fun. It's a great way to start the day. Now I'm like energized to go do my thing. Do what I do. All right. We'll talk soon, Michael.